Friday night hard news call with Tara and Rama. We greet all of you commanders, eagles, and angels, and we are grateful that you join us here tonight on this good day of that chewing energy. So thank you for joining us here. This is Rainbird, and I'd like to do a little bit of going around the medicine wheel and call in those sacred directions. So let's go into that heart space and just take a few breaths, breathing in through the nose and out through the mouth. A little bit longer out than in, but gentle. Just release that dross of the day. Find that place in your heart. All you good medicine ancestors, come, look this way. Join us here at this Rainbow Rose Roundtable. We're grateful for all of your teachings and all of your ways and all that wisdom you share with us. Thank you for whispering in our ears as we do our work here tonight. And thank you for your lives and for holding on to and passing on those good medicine ways. So, thank you for joining us here tonight. A host. Rising sun. Come, look this way. Eagle and condor and hawk. Thank you for bringing us that big picture of that vision we all hold and we share of Nacera. Thank you, White Knights, for all that you do now, and thank you for all of your good protection of your lives so that we can get this work done. Thank you for that illumination from that sun shining on our hearts. Thank you for all the waking up that we do in our lives. And thank you for those new beginnings, those new ways of being. All you good spirit beings of the North, come. Come join us here tonight, you tall standing nation. We are so grateful for you showing us how to be free with our arms in the air and blowing in the breeze and yet well-rooted and grounded in the Mother Earth. Thank you for your wisdom and all the knowledge you carry. Thank you, you good teachers of the North. Thank you for that being that bridge, linking us from birth to life, life to birth. Thank you for midwifing us as we transition into a new age and as our bodies change. We're grateful for the knowledge and the wisdom that we can embrace as we do this walk. Thank you for truth. Thank you for being gentle with us. Even though you may be what you are, that is, there is compassion there, and we're grateful. We're grateful for that grace, the grace that we are reminded of with that elk and the way that elk walks carrying that big rack with confidence and grace. So thank you, all you good beings of the North. Thank you for joining us here tonight. And you good ones of the West, that place of the setting sun, thank you for showing us how to balance the Nogwal with the Tonal. We're grateful for balance. We're grateful for that going within place. Grateful to Bear for showing us how to do that. And thank you. Thank you, Horse, for showing up in this good year of the Horse and reminding us that we can take a ride that way and how to stay in our power, not give it away. And thank you, Jaguar, for riding us through the Nogwal on your back. We're grateful for that dream time and that place of creation. So welcome, all you good ones of the North. I mean, West. Thank you for coming here. And all you good spirit keepers of the South, all you 13 clan grandmothers, welcome. Thank you for joining us here. And you good sisters of the Blue Corn and all your healing ways, come join us here. Thank you, children, for being in our lives and reminding us how to be innocent and how to surrender and how to trust and then sing and dance and take joy in life and all that it offers. Thank you for those good plant medicine people. And thank you, corn, for abundance that you bring us. We're grateful for this harvest. Oh, thank you, all you good ones of the South, and thank you to Coyote and Rabbit and all you good ones that remind us to laugh at ourselves. So, welcome, come to this Rainbow Rose Roundtable and join us. And Sky Nation, come, look this way, all you suns and planets and stars and galaxies, thank you to the universe of Nevadon for all that you show us and teach us and all your being. we're grateful for this time and this place on this earth to do our walk, and we're grateful for your support as we do what needs to be done here. We're grateful that you know what to do there, and we look forward to meeting in new and wonderful ways. So thank you, all you good star people, and thank you for the rain and the thunder and the lightning, and all those good sky beings. Thank you for being in our lives, and for all that you do. And Earth Mother, come join us here at this Stargate round table, or this Rainbow Rose round table, and the Stargate one too. We're grateful. We're grateful for our lives. Riding on your breast and all the ways that you nourish us and bring your abundance and how you heal us. All the good ways that you nurture us. So thank you, good Earth Mother. And Ho'oponopono. We're grateful for the day when we can plant these gardens of paradise and in a good way and heal all the things that we did that we didn't mean to do because we forgot that we love you. And we're grateful to remember all the ways that we could do better. Thank you for all those beautiful kingdoms and the elementals. Thank you for all of your lives and all the work that you do. And those, all the four-legged, thank you for your patience as we learn how to be good stewards. And thank you, all you dolphin and whale people. Thank you for your lives and for the work that you do, taking care of those oceans, those vast oceans. So we're grateful for the finned ones and the winged ones and the furry ones in all of the kingdoms. And those stone people with those healing ways and those Akashic record ways, those memories. Thank you for your heartbeat. Thank you, Mother Earth. Thank you for all of your beauty. We're so grateful and honored to be here at this time. And ancestors, seven generations back and on, and seven generations forward and on both sides, and oh, that's so many ancestors. We are so grateful for all that you do to hold that place, keep those bone memories. Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to be a hollow bone so that I might hear your words and feel that heartbeat that we all share. So thank you, all you good ancestors. Thank you for joining us here tonight. Ho. Aho Metakliasan. And in Lakash, you are another myself. So I'm going to just roll right into doing the housekeeping now. We're so grateful for all of our lives, and thank you for all the ways that you show up. This week for BBS Radio, we need $395, and that's not too bad at all. I know we can do that, and so we're grateful for all of you, especially those of you who've not yet paid it forward like that. To have this opportunity to contribute in this way is a blessing, and it is returned. And it's having that trust in the universe that makes it so sweet and wonderful. So here's your opportunity. These are the ways you can do it. You can go to bbsradio.com, click on Radio Station 2, look for one of our icons, the Stargate Roundtable with Marita, or the Hard News Call on Fridays with Taran Rama, or the Saturday Call, the History and the Sarah Call. Any one of those icons will work to take you to where it'll make a you can make a contribution to our needs here at the radio station. So thank you for doing it that way. That way you can use your plastics. And then the other way where you can just send it direct, you just put a tension down on the envelope and send it to BBS Network, comma, Inc., Incorporated, 5167 Toyon Lane, T-O-Y-O-N, in Paradise. And in case you're wondering, Paradise is in California. I'm sure there probably is one in every state, but California's got a good one. And that zip code is 95969. And you also put a memo in there that is for Tara and Rama Maria's calls. And we are grateful that that's a good way to do that. And then as we get this piece done, then we also contribute to Tara and Rama. Their rent is due, and they've got enough to make it through. But they do need money for food and gas. And so we are so grateful that for all the gifts that came forward for the rent this month and for these bills, they need money for printer cartridges and little things like that. But food and gas is really what we're hoping to get some money for them this week. So as your heart allows, let that be the case. Thank you so much for your gifts. And so the readings, if you would like a reading with Mother Sekhmet and Tara and Rama, that is a great triangulation right there. And a wonderful way to give yourself a treat and some insights into whatever it is you're wanting insights into. So there you go, all those possibilities. The way you send something directly to Tara and Rama, Ram D. Berkowitz, R-A-M, D. Berkowitz, B-E-R-K-O-W-I-T-Z, at 1704 B. Llano Street, L-L-A-N-O Street, number 249, in Santa Fe, New Mexico, 87505. So that's their mailing address. You'll find it on the website if you didn't get all that down. The website is 2013rainbowroundtable.ning.com. And there's a donate button on the homepage and just above the blog section. So that's where you'll find those two places where you can send a donation online and to Rama's PayPal account. So send it directly with a money order or a cashier's check, or use that your plastic online. So email address, as you're sending something, let them know that email address is Coran999@comcast.net. And if you need to make a phone contact, you can call Maria at 317-773-0061. And lots of gratitude that Tara and Rama can pay their rent, and gratitude for all the food that's coming their way and money. And let's just participate a little bit. As we are eating, we can send our nourishment that way as well. So that's just one way we can do it in the unified field, the Vision Quest way. I call it the Vision Quest diet. Oh, don't worry about taking seconds. You're not going to take those calories. You're sending them off. So it's a diet where you get to eat and eat and eat and eat. So those are my words, and I pass the talking stick. Over to you. Greetings, Tara and Rama. Are you there?
Greetings.
Aloha, everyone.
Thank you so much, Rainbird, as we join in this electronic talking circle across time and space, space-time.
I don't know if you're noticing, but I sure am. There is just a pile of stuff coming out of our ears everywhere. The news is just as crazy as a loony tube.
It is.
And they are building on their lies from the past. And there's a real humdinger of a lie out there now today. It's called, before I go on, I just wanted to say, I don't have that person's name, but yet yesterday, on the last word, Lawrence O'Donnell just honored a man, a family man, who was working with the softball team. And he was doing practice, and the way they do practice, you know, they practice their throws, you know, and they hit him, and they do the whole thing. Softball. And they have softball, and they have screens up so that in case it's a hard drive, it doesn't
hit you.
Well, somehow this quirky ball hit this man and killed him.
Oh, God.
Hit him right in the head and killed him. And he had a beautiful daughter and a son and beautiful wife. And it was heartbreaking, to say the least. And without even knowing his name, let's just put this kind of thing in the circle of support, because it happens a lot these days. And coming back to ourselves, we did a thing, hardly ever go out the world, and today we went to a talk about the wires that we are all hooked up around us to, from
yes.
cell phones to computers to
blow dryers.
I haven't had one of those my whole life, but
the wires outside your house with the
the television, everything. And it is a report they had, or you know, every time a town or a village goes on Wi-Fi across the whole town, or they're doing their smart meters and things
yes.
like this, the amount of radiation poisoning that we're all getting is, the doctors are all reporting across the board that their people that they have as their patients are getting much worse in their sicknesses and illnesses. And it's a serious show, but they have developed a natural counter indicator to this world of technology. And it's really something. It's creating this random wave current that the Earth is exactly the way it reports itself to us. It's you know, it's geologically random based on the nature that's around us and the changes that happen and all the weather modifications. It's not this regulated, intense, different type of frequency. And it really changes the whole story in a big way. I'm being kind of brief and kind of not very scientific right now, but we're going to get this one together, because everybody needs to help ourselves, assist ourselves with this, because what's happening is that it's an unnatural insert into our lives that you might say you're not having very much autonomy around it up until this little discovery. And then there's this water that just by its very nature now is healing everything from everything under the sun. We heard some folks, there's so many waters out there. They have been in touch with and testing every water under the sun, and it just has made a breakthrough. It's another breakthrough. So these are good things. And yes, it costs something at the moment, yet the cost to our life force and our health is a whole nother story, right?
Right.
And Nasara is definitely coming. These wild, crazy lies of stories. There's one of Nasara blogs and forums this comes from, and it's saying, from what I have been able to deduce and conclude regarding the RV, the global currency reset, and this is purely an educated opinion. The London Financial District is part and parcel of a world conglomeration involving the Federal Reserve System, the Bank of International Settlements, the International Monetary Fund, the Currency Bank, the Corporate Bank of Iraq, all of them. There's a bunch of them. World Bank, the Vatican Bank, and they have been manipulating the price of gold and silver for many years now by keeping the actual value very low. The reason for manipulating the gold and silver was to keep the value of the U.S. dollar and petrodollar high, in that the conglomeration controls the dollar, which has been the world's international currency since World War II. And then they go on and they talk about BRICS. And I'm going to say it again, whether they're saying it or not, BRICS is backed by the United States currency as well.
Yes.
And they make a case with China buying the lion's share of all this low-cost gold to the tune of when they get to 5,000 metric tons, it's supposed to break the back of the United States petrodollar and the U.S. regular dollar. And it will force, they say, I believe that China is about to revalue gold and silver on or about September 30th. That's the same day that, you know, our Congress has just flew the coop until after the elections in November. You know, some outlandish 2.5 months, I mean, or something. So, and there's not going to be anybody there to create a new budget on the 30th of September, which is the last day of our fiscal banking year, and October 1st is the first day.
So do we go into debt and default?
No, it doesn't matter because they're saying on the same day, September 30th, China will be revaluing the gold and silver on the same day, which they're saying here will place the BRICS alliance in control of all the world's monetary system. And this is supposedly a good thing because BRICS will then force the revaluation and the global currency reset. And I'll just say Rama talked to Mr. X about this whole thing and said the whole thing is based on a pack of lies.
Yeah.
And it's based on sand and more lies. And so nothing of the sort is coming. There will be no global reset. There will be no currency revaluation. And there will be no faction two dinars and anything else that's connected with that. This is
a fallacy. And what Mr. Rat shared with me is, as Chris Matthews put it on Hardball tonight, the clown car of these characters with Caribou Barbie and Mr. Green Eggs and Ham. I will not eat with Mr. Sam. Filibustering. Everything that is going on is the absolute total distractions that have to do with the fact this leads into who I spoke with today. I spoke with Master Sergeant Bob Dean, and he shared with me, our family is here. There is a mile-wide starship that is in a high geosynchronous orbit over North America. And there are trillions and trillions of starships in our atmosphere. And as they continue to just be here, and when the signal is given, they decloak. And then there will be so many ships in the sky. You will not see sky. You will see the undercraft of these ships. And then, like you have heard in that BBC message, this is the voice of the Ashtar Command. And we will be receiving our briefing orders.
We don't know when, no dates.
No dates, but Bob Dean was extremely excited today. I mean, he was practically wetting his pants talking about this. Simply because we're at that point now where the clown car of these Nazi war criminals that want to take us to the brink of default and blame it on Mr. 19.5 degrees. And
for the second time, mind you, we did exactly the same thing last year.
I mean, you can't trust the black man. You can't trust black people.
Tom Hartman puts it this way, as he actually quoted James Madison.
Yeah.
He says it's about something called faction, which people don't really understand the meaning of it. And James Madison said, by a faction, I mean a number of citizens who are united and adverse to the rights of the other citizens or to the permanent and aggregate interests of the community. They're adverse to that. And then they have only their small little 0.01.100001% interests do they have. Instability, injustice, and confusion introduced by faction into the public councils have in truth been the mortal diseases under which popular governments have everywhere perished. And this little Nasara Blogs and Forums story is one of those faction things.
Yes.
Total diseases and trying to make you think that that's for you. And I wanted to just back up a little bit. It wasn't a few months ago when there were two revaluation amounts where it was something like $3.80 for all the peons. And then the elites who had millions and millions of dollars worth invested into these dinars, they were going to get $38 and some cents
per
dinar. And if that didn't show you, I don't know what will. This is called faction. It disguised as faction two. Isn't it interesting? Faction two, where in the faction three that we're talking about is not this kind of faction.
No.
At all. It is actually, you might say, who we really are. We're all galactics.
Yes.
The ones that are being supported by this other idea of faction are not humans, much less galactics.
And Bernie Sanders reiterated that. He said, these folks are not human.
No.
And they are very much at the heart of this story to make this man a failure. Yet it is not a failure. There are extremely good things that Mr. 19.5 Degree has done for this planet and for this country. And in the same breath, those things don't get discussed on any level.
Oh, you know what? We should play this before it's too late.
Yeah, okay.
There's more to talk about, but I think we would rather now go and play. Naomi Klein came on Conversations with Great Minds, and it's another great one. We won't get it all finished, but let's start it. Mama, you got to go get the chair. Go get the chair.
The chair.
Yeah, just take it over there and set it until you get the chair. No, do it. Yeah, hold it, Pam. You got to hold it by the. Hold it over there. Okay, let's start.
Tonight's Conversations with Great Minds is award-winning journalist Naomi Klein, contributing editor for Harper's Magazine, as well as a columnist for The Guardian and The Nation. Naomi is one of the most influential voices writing today about the rise of and resistance to globalized capitalism. Naomi is also the author of a number of critically acclaimed books, including her latest, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. It's a must-read for anyone who wants to understand just how serious the global climate change crisis really is. Naomi Klein, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
It's so nice to have you here with us. I want to get into your book and all this stuff, but first I'd like to start with you. What got you into journalism? What got you interested in this of capitalism and culture that has been the arc through all three of your books that I've read?
Well, I think In terms of the kind of journalism that I practice, I guess sort of advocacy journalism and journalism embedded in social movements is something that I grew up with. My mom is a documentary filmmaker, and she was part of the sort of second wave of feminism that it was about women making films for themselves for the first times, and was very much part of sort of a consciousness raising movement. So I sort of really this idea that journalism and documentary filmmaking is about starting conversations and changing people's hearts, and that was what was going on in my living room, you know. And so I really owe my mom for that. And in terms of, you know, this, there is certainly a common thread connecting these books. And with No Logo, I think it was just that I had just happened to be, this is the first book I wrote it in my 20s, and I think I wrote it because I knew something was changing in the culture, and that once it changed, it would seem as if it was had always been like that, and that there was this sort of flip in the role that corporate power was playing in our lives, and that branding was playing in our lives. Even the word branding, you know, that was not a word that was used before, you know, the 90s. So I just felt like, okay, I need to sort of try to define this moment, or, you know, the next generation will think it's always been this way. That's what sort of started me on this journey, I guess.
And then from there to Shock Doctrine, which it's interesting with This Changes Everything, your new book. It seems like it's the logical extension of Shock Doctrine. This, you know, now we're going to use, in fact, you talked about several different places, and you've got a defense contractor you quote in here, you've got Arthur Anderson, I think, or one of the big, you know, great opportunities coming with the climate meltdown.
Yeah, and the Shock Doctrine ends with Hurricane Katrina, and actually starts with Hurricane Katrina. And, you know, when I was... When I was in New Orleans covering that disaster, both natural and unnatural, you know, I definitely had a feeling of, okay, is this a glimpse of the future that is going to become normalized as climate change intensifies and as we continue to neglect the public sphere? And, you know, it was just so brutal. And you know, years on, we see that New Orleans has become this laboratory for sort of a hyper-privatized city. The education system is now the most privatized in the United States. So I guess this book is... It's not exactly a sequel, but it's sort of like, what if we flip the script? You know, what if climate change became not an opportunity for the Shock Doctrine, but an opportunity for what I'm calling a people's shock, which, you know, a kind of blow from below, where rather than using crisis to stratify wealth ever further, to pillage the public sphere even more, which is what our system is built to do and what our system will do in the face of climate change and is already doing in the face of climate change. What if we as humanity rose in the face of this crisis and did what progressive movements have done in the past, which is really try to fix the underlying reason why these crises are happening in the first place? And, you know, I think it's precisely because I know the worst that humans are capable of in crisis that I think it's so important that we have a strategy for how to respond to climate change that brings out the best in us.
Would it be reasonable to say that if the Shock Doctrine is used for, you know, an earthquake or for a man-made event or whatever, you know, that's terrible, but it's recoverable. If the Shock Doctrine is used planet-wide, if they, you know, if they continue to push emissions to the point where we start passing tipping points that can never be recovered from, and in the meantime they're getting richer and richer and saying, hey, it's the next generation, that's not okay. That we've finally reached the point where we've gone beyond anything rational with regard to this kind of behavior on the part of capitalists.
I don't think it was even rational before, but I think the stakes are a lot higher. What's really frightening to me is I feel like people almost think it's inevitable that's the future we're going to build. You know, I feel like every time I go see, you know, a sci-fi movie that is showing us some vision of the future, it's the same story. It's, you know, some post-apocalyptic landscape and a tiny strata of huge winners and just teams of huge losers. It's the story of the Hunger Games. It's the story of Elysium. It's the story of Snowpiercer. I mean, going back further, it's, you know, we've told the story many times, but and even as I, you know, discuss the book with people, I feel like the biggest stumbling block is, you know, not people aren't arguing with me about the kinds of radical change that, you know, I'm arguing we need to adopt in the face of this crisis. People feel like it's impossible. They feel like we're already doomed, that we are just going to become us only more brutal in the face of this crisis. And I feel like that's the ultimate triumph of the free market era. It has been, is convincing us that we're not worthy of being saved. Hmm. I mean, that we're too selfish and too greedy. So not only can't we do it, but it's almost like, do we even think we're worth it?
Well, and to that point, in the introduction, you tell a couple of interesting stories, one about an airplane that's stuck on the tarmac here in D.C., the next about yourself, essentially, not being a climate denier like, you know, the crazies, but I think like many Americans just... Yeah. And I'd like you to riff on that a little bit. And then the third is this young man who just broke down in Copenhagen. And it seems like there's an arc through that that represents the book really well and that speaks to what you're just talking about.
Well, the plane, you know, this is a few summers ago now. It was record-breaking heat in Washington, D.C. And I saw a news story about how a U.S. Airways jet had gotten stuck on the runway because the asphalt had melted under the heat and the wheels just sunk in, and they'd asked all the passengers to get off the plane, hoping that that by lightening the load, they'd be able to tow the plane out. But that didn't work, so they brought in a bigger tow truck, and eventually they were able to lodge it loose, and everybody got back on the plane. And I was writing the book at the time and I kept wondering, is anybody going to talk about climate change and the connection between the emissions that we're all participating in emitting and the fact that the runway is melting? Or are we just going to pretend that we can get out of this by doing the same thing we're doing, only more so? And, you know, of course, none of the stories mentioned climate change. And I felt like that was a good image to start with, because I said, you know, we're all passengers on that jet, because we are. And this is why it is so hard to not be something of a climate change denier, because we live in a culture that makes it really, really hard to look at something as frightening as the reality that we are in the process and participating in a process of destabilizing our only home, the natural systems on which we all depend. And, you know, to on the one hand, be asked to read report after report about how glaciers are melting and species are going extinct. And, you know, people, you know, I often, you know, when people say they don't care about climate change, I often find that if you just push a little bit further, what you find is raw terror. And they just can't look. And I think that the terror is not just the terror in the face of these reports, because most of them are telling us there's things we can do to prevent the worst from happening, but it's the combination of that fear, that sort of existential terror, and living in a culture that is acting as if it's not happening, and not only just doing the same thing that we've always done, but actually, you know, doing the same thing that U.S. Airways did for the passengers on that jet, which is get an even bigger engine. And in our case, it's, you know, let's go from conventional oil to tar sands oil, and conventional gas to frack natural gas, and conventional coal to lignite coal, which is even dirtier. So it's not just like business as usual. It's doubling down on the very things that are causing the crisis, and taking on ever greater risks and bringing more and more people into the sacrifice zone.
And there are, and with this young man in Copenhagen, who was throughout the climate conference being so optimistic and so hopeful, and then in the end kind of fell apart. How do we prevent that from happening? How do we inspire hope in people when they're confronted with, I mean, we've got a video coming out next week, or actually it was released today, Leo DiCaprio's narrating, about the comparison between today and the Permian mass extinction. I mean, it's serious stuff.
Well, I mean, that was a real turning point moment for me being in Copenhagen. I was actually with Bill McKibben, and we spent, the last night kind of comforting this young man who's a fantastic activist. I'm not going to use his name, but he's a British activist. And he had pinned a great deal of hope on Obama, as so many others had at that point. You know, he had just been given a preemptive Nobel Prize. Copenhagen had been renamed, rebranded Copenhagen for the week. So in many ways, like, the Copenhagen summit was a sort of temporal and geographic extension of the Obama presidency and a presidential campaign, where it was sort of like that same sort of hopey feeling was that began during the campaign was extended into this climate summit. And that was sort of the stance of the movement, was like, Obama, come save us. It was this stature of supplication, really. There were signs all over Copenhagen just appealing to his moral conscience and also appealing to other leaders, appealing, posters everywhere addressed to Obama, addressed to Angela Merkel, saying, you know, what will you tell your grandchildren? But this, I say supplication because it was as if it was all up to them, and we were just sort of begging them to do the right thing. So that made me feel pretty hopeless. I feel much more hopeful now, because what I see among young climate activists today is that they are not waiting for Obama to finally live up to his promises. There's much more of an understanding of the power and economic dynamic of, you know, what is keeping Obama from acting, and strategies to change that power dynamic, and understanding that, you know, the real solutions are coming from below. So I think a lot has changed since that Copenhagen failure.
It's good that things are changing, and that this whole salvationist, I'd like to get back into that, and where we're at, where we're going. Germany, there's so many other things in just a moment. More of tonight. And welcome back to Conversations with Great Minds. I'm speaking with award-winning journalist Naomi Klein, author of the new book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. Naomi, growth, you know, conventional wisdom in capitalist society in America and Canada and the Western world is that we can grow our way out of everything, that growth is the answer to everything. You know, the old paraphrasing of Jack Kennedy, a rising tide lifts all yachts or all boats, but, you know, the sequel to that is, of course, only if you have a boat. What is the... And I know a lot of people, particularly when I discuss climate change with people who are, shall we say, on the other side, they'll say, oh, you want to destroy growth, you want to make the world poorer, all this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to that paradigm of growth, real growth, climate change, mm-hmm. carbon use, how these things fit together or don't?
Well, you know, I'm arguing in the book that there is a fundamental clash between our economy, our capitalist economy, such as it is, and what we need to do to respond to climate change. And, you know, these issues need a little bit of unpacking, because, you know, we have a certain kind of capitalism at this stage in history, which is sort of, Joseph Stiglitz calls it market fundamentalism. It's a particular brand of really unfettered, gloves off, deregulated capitalism. And, you know, one of the things I'm arguing in the book is the reason why we have failed to respond so spectacularly is because this crisis just had such bad timing. It landed on our laps at the end of the 80s. And, you know, scientists knew before, but it's the sort of mainstream coming out was 1988. Next year, the Berlin Wall collapses. Francis Fukuyama is declaring history over. This is the moment of triumph for the idea that, all governments need to do is just get out of the way of the market, and this frenzy of free trade deals is being signed. So I think we clearly have a clash between that kind of capitalism and what we need to do to respond to climate, because we have to regulate corporations so that they leave the carbon in the ground, and we have politicians that just seem unable to do that. We have to invest massively in the public sphere to have the public transit systems to protect ourselves from the coming storms. And we live in an age of austerity, and the whole idea of government spending is basically a non-starter. And then we've signed all these free trade deals that actually make it illegal to do a lot of really sensible things that we should be doing to switch to a green economy.
For example?
Well, I live in Toronto, and Ontario, my province, adopted actually the most aggressive green energy plan anywhere in North America in 2009. And they did, and our government did this in part because it was concerned about climate change, but also because it was facing a jobs crisis in the middle of an economic meltdown and in a province that is extraordinarily dependent on the big three automakers, and they were closing factories. So this policy was introduced as, okay, we're going to get off coal, but we're also going to create jobs for all of these people who are unemployed. And it was a really successful policy. I mean, there were all kinds of problems with the Green Energy Plan and in other areas, but when it came to job creation, 31,000 new jobs were created in the province. I profile one solar plant that is, you know, particularly a lovely little success story because they're making solar panels in what used to be an auto parts factory that had closed down and was sitting empty, and now they're producing solar panels. So it's sort of like exactly what you want, you know, the switch from the fossil fuel economy to the new green economy. And there were even a lot of workers from the old that closed car manufacturing companies that were now making solar panels. Well, what happened is that Japan and the European Union took Canada to a tribunal at the WTO and said that Canada was flouting its WTO obligations because it should not be discriminating against their companies because it had these incentives that you had to produce a certain amount of the equipment in Ontario. And the WTO ruled against us, and we lost that case. And so they changed the policy. So this is, you know, just one among many, many examples of how that whole logic is you know, just really incompatible with some really sensible things that governments, I think, just generally need to have a free hand to do as much as they can, as fast as they can, to bring emissions down. And this is where we get into the growth question, because what leading climate scientists are telling us is that we have now waited so long that there is what our mutual friend Michael Mann calls a procrastination penalty, which is to say that, you know, if we had done what we needed to do starting in 1990, starting in 1992, it could have been quite gradual and painless. And there's this weird thing about the whole sort of climate change policy wonk world. It's sort of in a bit of a time warp, like it hasn't actually changed its you know, its ideas, its sense of urgency. And here I'm not talking about the scientists, I'm talking about on the policy side, where we're still kind of acting as if it's 1992 or 1995, and we're still proposing these same policies within the same kind of framework, only it's not.
You're talking about gradual incrementalism.
Gradual incrementalism, you know, a little carbon tax here, maybe a little carbon trading there. But that's not where we are. Where we are is Kevin Anderson and Alice Bowes at the Tyndall Center talk about how we now need to be cutting our emissions in the wealthy world, in the industrialized world, by 8 to 10% a year. Now, that kind of cut is not, there's no precedent for it taking place outside of an economic crisis.
Well, Germany has, I'm just thinking electricity.
Yeah. Well, Germany is a really interesting case. And I mean, but just coming back to the growth, your growth question, it's so in the face of this, obviously we don't want a crisis. We don't want to replicate the Great Depression. But we do need to cut our emissions. So we need, what they call it strategic degrowth. You know, I think what we just need is a strategic economy. We need to manage our economy so we contract in those parts of our economy where we're overusing resources and overusing sinks, atmospheric sinks, and we expand those parts of our economy that are already low carbon. And there are all these reports that are coming out, you know, from institutions like the IMF and and out of the UN that say, look, we can do this. It's, you know, it's not going to impact growth. It's compatible with growth. In the long term, it's going to be better for our economies. That's true, but the problem is that we are governed by an ideology that doesn't allow us to plan and manage and think long term. So the kind of growth that we have, which is just indiscriminate, short term, just, you know, whatever it takes to grow the economy in the fastest possible way, which is why my government in Canada is just digging up Northern Alberta as fast as it possibly can. It's all happening in the name of economic growth. So I think that that's the clash, and the clash is this particular model of growth. So it's not to say that you can't have a growing economy, you just can't have this kind of economy growing.
Well, and in a way, you're suggesting that we rethink capitalism. How?
Well, we have a really extreme form of capitalism, and this growth imperative is really at the heart of it. I think, I don't know exactly what to call what we need to do. I mean, there's big debates about it, but it's, and I think there's a lot of discomfort about just saying the word capitalism, but I don't think that we know how to think about capitalism without that growth imperative at this stage in history. There have been points where, Keynes had believed that at a certain point we would stabilize, we would become a steady state economy, and we would not need to expand infinitely. And
we'll have to finish the last little bit when we come back, everybody. And that's really where we are. And I'm just going to say really quick, it's time to go to the next hour. On the conference line, it's 860-970-0300. And then the pin code's the same, 2323 23 23 pound. We'll be seeing you there for an hour. And then at the top of the next hour, the best radio show in the universe. And we've got some more to share. Namaste.